too far beyond rated requirement for a good antenna. Okay, I know we're beyond time here. Wesley wanted to say a few words, and then Glenn, if he's still with us. Wesley, WN2XJN, go right ahead, KQRIW.
Reflector, 9126, link clear.
Actually, I got confused by listening to you and to XJN. I got confused. From one hand, I was trying to say everything what Dick said, and I was agreeing with him, but then I found that actually you did the capacitive component of the reactance is very important. It exists on the plate of the capacitor, and all you then I was thinking, okay, well, if you have a line, feeding line of 50 ohms, and then you have a bird of 50 ohms, you're still tuning to the 50 ohms that is coming from there, where the, so then the rest of the matchbox has to come to the point where it's actually seeing that 50 ohms coming into back to the XJN.
I think I know what you're getting at, Wesley, and you're expressing a commonly held opinion that maybe is not accurate. And you said two transmissions ago, quarter wavelength of transmission line. If I've got the output of an antenna tuner going into a 50 ohm bird watt meter, going into a 50 ohm transmission line, and if that transmission line is 50 feet long, going into an antenna, most people will accept that as a reasonable situation. What I am saying, which is a little bit different from what most people say, is I can take that 50-foot long transmission line, I can shorten it to 10 feet, 3 feet, 1 feet, 1 inch, 0. I can take the output center conductor of the bird watt meter, feed it directly to the wire of the antenna trailing out of the back of that airplane. And that is not an invalid situation. I will admit that interpreting the results are not easy, but it is a valid situation. But as long as I don't exceed certain specifications of that bird watt meter, it can give me a rational answer, a reasonable answer traceable to the Bureau. That's what I'm saying. I know people are not going to agree with that. I know that in itself is going to create a whole lot of discussions. I accept that. It's not an easy concept to accept. There's nothing magic about a transmission line being a wavelength long, a half wavelength long, a quarter wavelength long, zero wavelength long. You haven't violated physics or anything else reasonable. Now, if I made the antenna 10 to the 12 ohms, yes, the bird watt meter is going to go crazy. It's going to be looking at ridiculous voltages, and it's going to arc over. I'm going way beyond design specifications. And correspondingly, if the antenna represented a milliohm, I'm way beyond current capability design. But if I stay within reasonable performance, let me drop, within reasonable specifications of that bird watt meter, I am convinced I can use a zero length transmission line into that wire antenna or any other kind of antenna and get a rational result if I'm smart enough. And I'm not violating physics and I'm not violating bird watt meter within reason. I know that we're going to have a lot of more discussions about that. We're all going to get smarter. Glenn wanted to make a couple of comments, then I got to pass it over to Mel so he could say goodbye to everybody. We got on one of his letter subjects, but boy, did we get into a hot one. Glenn, KC2QIQ, if we haven't put you to sleep, and give us a little more audio, shout into that thing, KQRIW in the tech net. Wait for the beep, Glenn.
How's this, Dick? A little bit better, and my comments now have built up to at least a few.
I can't understand that. We haven't said anything controversial, have we? Your audio sounds very good. Please proceed. Wait for the beep.
My first comment is really for Bob, and the way I'd like to put this is, let's say if I had an antenna that's at the end of a transmission line, and it's no longer 50 ohms. I've either cut it too short or I made it too long. And now what I do is I make a balun and design a balun or a transmission impedance match on the other side to match it back to 50 ohms again. Even though the antenna is no longer resonant because I've rematched the impedance again, it is resonant back into that feed line. If I do it with a balun, then there's nothing imbalanced. So I could do that, and all the radiated power goes out the antenna, and the only loss is what's in the balun, and the balun could be less than a quarter of a dB of loss. I've done this many, many times in practice. Let the machine reset for a second. The second comment was about the feed lines. In other words, Mel talks about a situation where somebody's using an antenna tuner inside the shack. There's a transmission line and an antenna. And a lot of times when the antenna is nicely matched to the feed line and it's mounted up in a nice transmission point, the antenna has a really nice pattern. And the pattern matches beautifully almost to the textbook, especially if it's mounted at the right height and everything. Now, if you take that same antenna and you operate it off of its frequency to a corner or, quite a bit further away, and your VSWR starts stepping up a bit. Now what happens is you go and you correct the VSWR. Maybe it's only 2.5 or 3:1. The transmitter can still tolerate it. You retune the tuner. All of a sudden, the VSWR match to the transceiver looks really, really good. The problem now is that the transmission line, and I've seen this in practice, all of a sudden becomes part of the transmission, the whole antenna system, just like the antenna is. So instead of just the antenna radiating, now what's happening is you have the transmission line radiating. What happens is the pattern's no longer the same. So stations that heard you one way before, now your signal is degraded as it's going over the horizon because your pattern is totally different. And sometimes this happens on HF frequencies with long transmission lines feeding antennas, and you're using them at a corner of where the antenna is supposed to be operating.
Welcome to the New England Reflector, 912.
Channel 6.
I'm going to add to something that Glenn just said. And I'm going to combine it with something that Bob said. Bob said if the antenna is off resonance, where it's presenting a highly capacitive or highly inductive load, that the antenna tuner behaves a particular way, and the antenna tuner has an easier time when the antenna is on resonance, but just wrong in impedance. I'm going to agree with that. But now let me take a ridiculous result. I've got an antenna that is purely resonant. No reactants. That's the good news. But it's a 2:1 standing wave ratio because the antenna is a 25 ohm resistive impedance on the end of a 50 ohm transmission line. 2:1 standing wave ratio. That's what it is right at the end of the transmission line. Now with my network analyzer, my slotted line, whatever, I decide to take measurements further back on that exact same transmission line that's operating at a 2:1 standing wave ratio. And by the way, 2:1 standing wave ratio is very close to a 10 decibel reflection coefficient. It's really 9.5, but let me round it off to 10. There's a 10 dB reflection coefficient in every single transmission line that has a 2:1 standing wave ratio on the transmission line. Reflection everywhere along that transmission line. By way of a slotted line, by way of directional coupler, by way of a network analyzer, I can measure an S11 of minus 10 decibels, a third of the voltage. If I decide to make the transmission line, let me think now, an eighth of a wave long, or some number of wavelengths added to an eighth wave, one and a one-eighth, two and one-eighth, an eighth of a wavelength long, the 2:1 standing wave ratio, which was a 25 ohm resistor, reactive. Now, let me think now. Is it inductive or capacitive? It's inductive. It's a strong inductor, an eighth of a wave away from the antenna. So if I take a pure resonant antenna, 50 ohms, for the 2:1 standing wave ratio, and I go through an eighth of a wave of transmission line, it looks like a highly inductive antenna, as if it was off resonance. Or I can make the antenna a pure 50-ohm resistor.
Repeater, timeout.
I can make the antenna a pure 50-ohm resistor, but off-resonant so that it presents enough inductance that I've got a 2-to-1 VIS-1, a 1/3 voltage reflection coefficient. To that bird wattmeter, both of those conditions are the same. The antenna off-resonance, right at the antenna, with a 10 dB reflection coefficient, or a perfectly resonant antenna with a 2-to-1 VIS-1, again, an eighth of a wavelength down the transmission line, look identical at that point of impedance measurement. I'm using that as an example to say that there's nothing magic about the antenna being off-resonant. There's nothing magic about the antenna being wrong in VIS-1, but being purely resistive. In either case, I can force it to be an exactly 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, 10 dB reflection coefficient, 1/3 reflected voltage. When I plot a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio on a Smith chart, it is a circle with the voltage on that circle 1/3 the voltage. 1/3 the radius of the whole damn Smith chart is the radius of that circle I drew with my compass. And every one of those points along the circle is a valid 2-to-1 VIS-1. Some of them look like they're wrong in impedance by 100 ohms. Some of them are wrong in impedance by 25 ohms. Some of them look like they're wrong in reactance by being highly inductive, wrong in resonance. Some of them look wrong in resonance by being highly capacitive. There's nothing magic about any one of those points, in my opinion. Let me drop.
C2QIQ, can I make my final comment, though, Dick?
Yeah, I know that I know there's going to be a lot of controversy on this one. I know we're not going to settle it tonight. Glenn, and then Bob in that order. Glenn, go ahead.
Yeah, my last comment, Dick, I'm sorry about this, but it was just that, you know, we were talking about bird wattmeters, and just having a little bit of experience with these things, working with, you know, doing load pulls on amplifiers, working for microwave power devices for a few years, you know, we had a metrology department where we would test our bird wattmeters and other instrumentations using, you know, HP loads with couplers and everything else, and bird being one of the more interesting ones, is that you could take a load, take 50 ohms, and use in, like one of those EIL amps, the lab amps, and drive it into a bird wattmeter and with the slug in the forward direction and watch the power. Put it in reverse, measure the power. Then do a 2-to-1, take a T, put it in a line, make it 2-to-1, look at the forward, look at the reverse power, write it down on a piece of paper, check it over a bunch of frequencies. Then do a 4-to-1, take 4 50-ohm loads, and then do it forward slug, reverse slug, write down the measurements. Now that's 4-to-1, and then you want to make it even better. I've even tried putting a trombone in series and phase shifters and put them in series with the line and start swinging them all over the place. Look at the forward and reverse direction on the bird wattmeter. They are quite robust, and they're well within their tolerances to at least 4-to-1. And by using the trombone, you can look at it through all phases. So, you know, that's a pretty robust meter. I have to agree with them a little bit on the coupler and using like an HP power head, because the coupler, when you start swinging through different impedances on a coupler, you will get a ripple through it. But there again, 3 dB, you know, much more than that is a little hard to believe. KC2QIQ.
I personally have tested a bird wattmeter by putting it through a transmission line, a 50 ohm transmission line, into a dead short circuit. 1 watt forward, 1 watt coming back. It measured 1 watt forward, it measured 1 watt coming back. That's an infinite standing wave ratio. It gives the right answer, as long as you don't exceed the power capability. I'll admit that if it's rated for 100 watts max, and I put 100 watts into a dead short circuit, I might very well see something crazy. Maybe when I go that high in standing wave ratio, I have to go down to 50 watts or 20 watts on the 100 watt slug before it starts going crazy. But still, within reason, it can measure an infinite standing wave ratio. A dead short circuit, it'll measure the correct forward power and reverse power. Many people calibrate the machine by doing just that. And there's nothing magic about a short circuit. A certain length of transmission line into an open circuit, again, is an infinite standing wave ratio. W2ILP, K2RW, wait for the beat, Bob.
Hey, W2RIW W2ILT, this argument is nothing new at all. The late Lou McCoy, when he was lab manager for the ARRO, after getting several correspondence from me, agreed with me. The ARRO is evaluating high power antenna tuners, and people are trying to test them with high viswise of 5-to-1 even. But the point I'm trying to make that you see, don't want to recognize is the output of antenna tuners can have very little insertion loss from the input as long as we're matching a resistive impedance. If you match any flat impedance, I don't care what it is, and you have a good antenna coupler, you'll get a trans ratio set up that'll make an impedance match. That's not my argument. If you get an antenna that is far from any reasonable resonant mode, you have to make up for the conjugate match. The output of the antenna coupler does not see a resistive load. Now what happens is a lot of these all-wire antennas, all-band antennas that are all wires, why do you think they use 400 ohm ladder line or other high impedances? It's a compromise. It's a compromise so that the output of the tuner won't have to work so hard. Because they're not 50 ohms in order to cover all that frequency range. And there again, you're putting part of the antenna into the transmission line and part of it into the tuner. The whole idea of an antenna coupler is to do two things at the same time, to match impedance and to trim the load. Sometimes the antenna is only a little bit off resonance. It only requires a little bit trimming to get there. And you can easily see that the antenna tuner can handle that. But if it's really far off, the antenna tuner may overheat. And this happens in a lot of cases. And that's why if you're going to handle higher power, you have to have an antenna tuner that's capable of radiating that power inside the box. Back to you, Dick, from W2LLP.
Okay, let me take a ridiculous situation to prove a point. You'll admit that if I had a pure 50-ohm resistor and the output of the antenna tuner directly from its semiconductor to the shield, and I adjust the antenna tuner or take out the antenna tuner, and I'm transmitting 100 watts, no problem. 100 watts goes forward in both cases. But now I leave the 50-ohm resistor there, and I put an inductor across the 50-ohm resistor, and I adjust the inductor for 50 ohms of inductive reactance. I've now got 50 ohms of inductive reactance in parallel with a 50-ohm resistor. That's the equivalent of a highly inductive antenna, an antenna that's way above resonance. I'm using it's a 3.5 meg antenna, and I'm using it at 5 meg. I might get that. So I've got a pure 50-ohm resistor and a 50-ohm inductive reactance inductor in parallel. And I've got a pure 100-watt transmitter, and I now adjust the controls on that antenna tuner. When I finally finish adjusting those controls on the antenna tuner, I say that that resistor will see 100 watts. The antenna tuner, if it's well designed, will dissipate nothing. There'll be a significant amount of inductive, reactive current flowing through that 50 ohm inductive reactance. But still, that antenna tuner will pour 100 watts of power into that 50 ohm resistor, even though there's a 50 ohm inductive reactance inductor across it. As long as those controls on the antenna tuner don't run out of range, I say it will do that. You're allowed to agree or disagree. W2ILP, K2RIW, wait for the beep.
W2ILT. I'm Womanhood with Power. ILT. What I will tell you now is go back to your network's textbook and find out what happens at a particular frequency when you put a resistor across an inductor. It's no longer a resistor load at that frequency. You have a complex impedance. So you're not going to get the full power going across the 50 ohms. Part of that power is going to be a complex power. It's not imaginary power. It's going to have to be compensated in the tuner. And if it's not compensated, it's going to be even more worse. The 50 ohms that's in parallel with the inductance can be calculated at that particular frequency, just like you calculate any network where you have inductance, capacitance, and resistance. In fact, you could have a coil of wire that has the resistance of 50 ohms and be inductive, and it still will do what I'm saying. So back to you, Dick, from W2IOP.
Okay, the 50 ohm resistor with a 50 ohm inductor reactance across it is a brand new impedance as a series equivalent circuit. It's a 25 ohm resistor in series with a 25 ohm inductor. Doesn't matter. It is a 3.2 standing wave ratio. To me, a 3.2 standing wave ratio is not beyond reason. Are you telling me that the antenna tuner cannot properly match a 3.2 standing wave ratio? I know you're not saying that. A 3.2 standing wave ratio as an antenna with a good brand of antenna tuner is perfectly acceptable. I just made one, a 3.2 standing wave ratio, with a 50 ohm inductor and a 50 ohm resistor. You're telling me I can't do that. Why not? And why wouldn't that antenna tuner, properly adjusted, put 100 watts of power into that resistor, put some amount of reactive power into the inductor, but that is not continuous power absorption in the inductor. If it's a high-quality inductor, it absorbs no continuous power. It's got some stored energy. On each half cycle, it's going in and coming back out, but there is no continuous power dissipated by the inductor, and 100 watts will be dissipated by that resistor, and it's a perfectly normal 3.2 standing wave ratio. What law have I violated, Bob? W2ILP. Wait for the beep. K2LIW.
K2LIW from W2ILP. You forget the impedance formula for reactance. Reactance has in it formula frequency. The frequency that you're operating on will determine what its equivalent load current will be. And it'll have to share that power with the fixed resistor. The antenna tuner, if it's a decent tuner, will have no trouble tuning up to that power and matching that impedance. However, the reactors there, well, if far off the frequency, will cause the tuner to have to trim for it. And you can't get away with that. You have to look at the tuner as a variable transformer for impedance. And it can do that very well without insertion loss. But it can't make or up for a non-resonant antenna or feed in some inductance or capacitance at the output that it can't compensate for. And if it does compensate for it, it has to absorb some power, so there's a power loss within the tuner, effectively. And that's what Lumicore agreed with me, and that's why they got to make high-power antenna couplers very large and able to handle that power. Back to you, Bill. Back to you, Dick from W2ILP.
There's an infinite number of ways I can make a 3.2 to 1 standing wave ratio. I can draw a circle of something like a 0.4. Let's see, what was the number? I forget what it was. 0.41 volts radius on a Smith chart. And every one of the dots along that circle is a 3 to 1 Vizwar. I can make a 3.2 to 1 Vizwar by multiplying 50 ohms by 3.21, 161 ohms. 162 ohms, I'll call it. If my antenna was a pure resistor of 162 ohms, 3.2 to 1 standing wave ratio, I'm pretty sure you'd say the antenna tuner of good design can easily handle that. Now, by another technique, I'm making a 3.2 to 1 standing wave ratio by using 50 ohms in parallel with 50 ohms of inductive reactance. That's another point on that circle on that Smith chart, which at the right position along a transmission line, the right number of wavelengths back from the antenna, that's the exact impedance I'm going to get. So now, Bob, I'm going to ask you an extremely direct question. You and I have just designed a good, transmission line, a good antenna tuner. And the name of the company that did it is the Wechselbaum Nadel Company. Good, respected firm. Located in Comac. Make lots of products, and most of their customers are very happy. And this antenna tuner of good design can match any phase angle of a 3.2 to 1 standing wave ratio. And when I first do the test, I take my 100-watt transmitter through the antenna tuner into a pure 50-ohm resistor, 100 watts get there. Now I put that 100-ohm inductive reactor in parallel with the 50-ohm resistor. I've now gone from a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio to a 3.2-to-1 standing wave ratio, and the Wechselbaum Nadel antenna tuner can handle that. And I readjust tuning controls. How many watts gets to that 100-ohm resistor? W2ILP, K2RIW, wait for the beep.
This is W2ILP again, K2RIW, W2ILP again speaking. That you have to realize that we're talking about RF. We're not talking about DC. We're talking about RF. And the RF frequency will determine actually how much voltage appears across that fixed resistor of 50 ohms. It's not going to be the full amount if that inductor is across it, because there is going to be some capacitive reactance added within the tuner to cause that to look like 50 ohms resistive. And it's no longer going to actually be getting the same wattage it would have got without the inductor across it. The trouble with most people is they're just thinking of antennas and transmission lines and standing waves. You're not thinking of the same situation where you just talk about a network, an AC network. If we were talking about electrical power distribution networks, we'd be talking about power factor, and we'd be talking about all sorts of things to show that in AC, a resistor isn't the only thing it's cracked up to be when there's inductive reactance or capacitive reactance around it. The same laws that hold for low power AC distribution certainly hold for RF. Back to you, Dick, from W2ILP.
KC2, QIQ with a comment to that?
Glenn recognized, but I got another very critical question. I'm running at 3.5 megacycles, a perfectly valid frequency for you and I to use, Bob. I've got a 50-ohm dummy load. That's a good 50-ohm resistor at 3.5 megs. I put a high-quality inductor across it and adjusted it for the right number of microhenries, so it is a 50-ohm inductive reactance at 3.5 megacycles. If I now put a capacitor also across that inductor, and it's the right number of picofarads. So if the capacitor is 50 ohms of capacitive reactance, I've got a 50 ohm capacitive reactance in parallel with a 50 ohm inductive reactance at 3.5 megacycles. It is resonant. That parallel LC at that resonant frequency at 3.5 megs is an open circuit. I've got an open circuit across the 50 ohm resistor. I've resonated it. The inductor of 50 ohms is essentially gone, and 100 watts goes into that resistor. If the Pi network inside of the antenna tuner, the Wechselbaum natal antenna tuner, if the Pi network has a C2 capacitor that can go to the right number of picofarads to be a 50 ohm capacitive reactance, it has just resonated that 50 ohm inductor I've got across the resistor. The 50 ohm inductor is gone, and all of the 100 watts goes into the 50 ohm resistor. What law have I violated when I did that? W2ILP, wait for the beep, K2RIW.
You have violated no law because you created a tuned tank circuit that's resonant. It's just like if you had a power amplifier, RF power amplifier, and you tuned for resonance, and a plate current dips at resonance. Why does it dip at resonance? Because you got an efficient transfer of RF power. Once you put that capacitor in with the inductor, and the two of them together become resonant, they're invisible. The only load is at 50 ohms, which is a flat load which will be able to handle the full power that will be available. My argument is only that when you have an inductive reactive load or capacitive reactive load, it's not the same thing as just having a pure resistor there. Back to you, Dick from W2ILP.
Okay, I've got this 50 ohm inductor across the 50 ohm resistor. The 50 ohm inductor shouldn't be there. I can get rid of it electronically by putting a 50 ohm capacitor reactance across the inductor. I can do that right at that RL that I had before. It becomes an RLC. And now that lump is sitting right at the output connector of the antenna tuner. Does anything bad happen if I don't put the external capacitor, but I make the C2 capacitor of the Pi network inside of the antenna tuner? I make the output loading capacitor go to 50 ohms of inductance, of capacitive reactance. It's at the exact same point, but now it just happens to be inside the box. The box has a 16th of an inch wall, so that capacitor is a 16th of an inch away. A 3.5 megs, that's not bad. Did I do something bad because I used the capacitor inside the box as the loading capacitor of the Pi network, as opposed to putting the capacitor outside the box directly across the inductor? Have I done anything bad when I did that? Why can't that work at near 100% efficiency? What's wrong? W2ILP, wait for the beep, K2RIW.
So what you want to say is that the reactance is imaginary and the capacitor doesn't absorb any energy. And that is another argument. Because if that was the case, you could build all the tuners a lot smaller than you build them. What happens is that it doesn't matter how you cut it, where you put the capacitor or inductance, unless they counterbalance each other and make a conjugate match, then you're not going to get the maximum RF output. And it doesn't matter where you put them. Now, if the antenna is really far off resonance, you can see that you'd have to put a lot inside the box. But if it's only a little bit off resonance, it might not have more loss than small insertion loss to trim it up, which is the case in a lot of antennas. We don't have to trim them up to get from one end of a ham band to the other. We're not really putting a lot more reactants in the box. And that's why it works for us. But there's a lot of misconception about low-band, long-wire antennas that you can tune up on any frequency because you have an antenna coupler. And it's been proven wrong. What we even did at Collins Rockwell, and I worked at a service center in New York, in Lake Success, which is no longer there, where we service a lot of these avionics products. We had a variable vacuum capacitor at the output, and we could turn that capacitor. We had to be really careful because it was hot with RF. You had to have a shaft with a very well-insulated knob. You could turn that capacitor and you could see the inductor within the automatic antenna coupler pulling as you turned the capacitor at the output. That was one of the tests we made. So, there we are, putting more of the antenna into the tuner because it has to compensate for the capacitor. And these are the kind of tests that we made to see that the tuner was working properly. So, we could see it obvious by using a thermocouple and an orthostatic voltmeter what was actually coming out of the tuner port when we did things like that. And unless you feed a flat dummy load, it's not inductive. Why do they sell dummy loads that are not inductive? Because...
Repeater, timeout.
You timed out, Bob, but I heard you on the input, so don't worry. And Glenn probably heard you on the input, too, and so did Wesley. I'm going to agree with you that as you start feeding reactive loads, and now you've got reactive currents flowing in the antenna tuner, because of the finite Q of those LC networks that's in the antenna tuner, extra loss mechanisms come into effect. I'm going to agree with you. However, if I am using transmitting grade inductors and transmitting grade capacitors, good large sized ones, in this well built quality antenna tuner by the Wechselbaum Nadel Company, to say that the inductors and capacitors have a Q of 300 is not unreasonable. That means that when a capacitor or an inductor is set for 50 ohms of capacitor reactants or inductive reactants at 3.5 megacycles, a Q of 300 means that there is an equivalent series resistor of 0.16 ohms when it's presenting 50 ohms of reactants, inductive, or capacitor. Let me drop. So now, this quality antenna tuner that you and I are describing, I use a quality inductor on the outside of the box, 50 ohms of inductive reactants at 3.5 megacycles. It's got a Q of 50, a Q of 300. It's got 0.16 ohms of equivalent series resistance in series with 50 ohms of inductive reactants. That's the total inductor I'm putting across the 50 ohm load. And the quality capacitor, that's the loading capacitor of our antenna tuner, also has a Q of 300, a reasonable number. It's presenting 300 ohms of capacitive reactants right at the output connector, capacitive reactants to ground from semiconductors, so to speak. That's the loading capacitor. It's also got 0.16 ohms of equivalent series resistor. With those quality components, Q of 300, if I put 100 watts into that antenna tuner, can I reasonably expect to get 99 watts delivered to that 50 ohm resistor? Am I crazy to expect that, Bob? W2ILP, wait for the beep, and interrupt every minute, K2RIW.
K2RIW from W2ILP. Once you start feeding numbers into the problem, you're avoiding it. because you're saying that there is a loss in there. Your first statement in there, where you agreed with me, I agree with, because it's obvious. Now, when you start putting numbers in there, this thing really isn't that far off. I'm only going to get an ohm or a fraction of an ohm. It's probably possible. But even with automatic antenna couplers, you get all sorts of trouble. There was a point around 19 megahertz where these antenna couplers wouldn't tune up. And that was another point where we were going through with the loads they were using, because they used dummy loads that consisted of capacitors and resistors and inductors that looked like the complex load of the probe antenna in order to load this thing. They were loading it up with a 50 ohm load. They were loading it up with the practical impedance of what the antenna would look like. And there was another point around 19 megahertz where the thing would turn up. They couldn't find a null because it was going through the point where the load was looking, going from the capacitive reactors to inductive reactors. Now, maybe I should explain to you at the very beginning that they never intended these antenna couplers to match 50 ohms. They were a ham station, it's an avionics transmitter, and they're flying at altitude. They start out with 600 watts PEP, and if they can get 25 watts out, they're happy because they have altitude. So their criteria is not to get the full power out, because they know they can't. It's too much loss in the antenna coupling system, and the type of antennas that they're trying to use only band from 2 to 30 megahertz. Back to you, Dick, from W2LLP.
GZ2, QAQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized. Depending on the size of the components, the physical layout, you can have other distributed inductance and therefore run into funny resonances at 19 megacycles. That's easy to happen. Not easy to analyze until you run into it the first time. I accept that. I don't think it would do that at 3.5 meg. That's part of why I chose that frequency. And yes, there's many an antenna tuner in the automatic mode where it grinds and grinds and doesn't find a solution and gets confused. And there's explanations for how that happens. I think we're slowly coming to a slightly higher understanding, though, of what conventional ham radio type antenna tuners are capable of. I bet you've seen some of these problems, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the hardest things that for people to understand is, you know, impedance transformation and exactly how that works, you know, in studying true two-port analysis and running through the Smith chart, going back through insertion loss, return loss, and looking at all these items. And just going back to your standard VSWR equations again and just look at what's actually happening across feed lines. It's amazing at how many times I would design RFPA amplifiers where the collector of a transistor is fractions of an ohm at power, and it has to drive a 50 ohm connector. And I would actually design the strip line with very, very low loss between the collector of the transistor to the 50 ohm output connector, and basically had supply a nice 50 ohm output or something very close to 50 ohms across a PA amplifier that had to operate from 500 kilohertz to 30 megahertz, and you know, basically tuning the input VSWR and everything on these modules. And then to complicate matters worse, you'd have to stack these PA modules and then drive them into combiners and dividers. So you have to put a 50 ohm input in and then drive 8 modules. And then you have to combine them again on the other side. And in each case, you can keep the losses very, very low, provided you're looking at, well, you know, every area on the Smith chart. You look, just design everything very, very carefully. And there again, you know, multiple poles help a lot. You know, and a lot of times a simple antenna tuner, like for ham radio, it's just an L and a C, or maybe a ganged L and a C, where the more stages that you have of L's and C's give you a lot greater variety of area to tune so that you can, you know, take care of a lot of these things. And here again, making things very, very small. If it doesn't have to be adjustable and you do things on strip line in like VHF, wow, you can get things really, really tiny. But when you have to make it adjustable and variable, now you're talking about ganged devices that with multiple stages covering multiple bands becomes a little bit more difficult and raises the level of your expertise, so to speak. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Good stuff. Yeah, when some of those transistors give you a fraction of one ohm impedance, and you've got to match that to a 50-ohm world, sometimes you don't. There's nothing magic about using other impedances within the microstrip circuit itself or strip line circuit. But in order to couple it to ordinary instrumentation and feed lines, you usually have to eventually match to 50 ohms or 70 ohms. And to do that in broadband at the 100-watt or 1,000-watt level at a fraction of an ohm, sometimes the circuits look pretty crazy. We got to stop this for tonight. We've been keeping everybody up way beyond the normal. We've hit a brand new record for a TechNet.
Hey, Jake?
This is, yes, sir?
Hey, sir, Jay, just to point out that most automatic tuners, if anything, they have a motorized capacitor, but most automatic tuners are a series of relays and coils, and a little computer to figure out their solution, as opposed to something that I would consider to be high quality, which was a Rollo inductor with a motor and a capacitor and a motor, which makes the traditional Pi, which then... when you find a solution, the solution is just like you would do manually, so to speak, with a loading capacitor and a loading coil. Anyway, the repeater's going to shut itself off in about 4 minutes.
Okay, we've really hit the end of our rope. This was TechNet number 1,283, which has run to a brand new late time. We've broken a brand new record. That ain't good. We're not going to do this more often. 73 you all. TechNet number 1,283. We're closing it down for tonight. Be kind to each other. Mel, if you're still awake, say some words. And boy, did we cover a mail item tonight. But we didn't finish it, as you can tell. There's more to it, obviously. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY, yep. Gotta get to bed. Okay, just a final word. Yes, there's a lot more to this. There's a lot of misunderstanding. And what we can do, I can take it, we can start and take this step by step and go with each step of the way and all, and then we can, I think, iron out a lot of these points. But the ARRL, doing evaluation of the tuners, use the Johnson Viking Matchbox. I won't get into the reasons why, but you talk about a well-designed tuner of the 1950s, the Johnson Matchbox system. They had both the small one and they had the big one I have, the Johnson Kilowatt Matchbox. And they have used that as, like I say, the criteria. I'll get into that why next week, and then I'll tell you why it works correctly. And there's a number of factors. But good agreement with you, Dick, about the first watt meter and putting it in. Done those experiments. In fact, I'll even expand on another experiment was done with hanging actually meters on an antenna and what the results were. So we'll let that go. 73s, everybody. Take care, and we'll pick it up next week. This is K2KEY. Good night, all.
Good night, Mel. And one final word for Eric, and that is some of the antenna tuners have a poor man's equivalent of a vector network analyzer inside, where they literally look at the input connector coming from the transceiver. It measures reflection coefficient and phase angle in order to know which way to go with the controls that it is tuning. Some of them do that. Some of them do simpler things than that. There's all kinds of ways of doing it. Bye-bye, you all. Next week, we'll almost settle some of these issues. K2RIW, really clear.
All right, Jake. K2RIW. You know, we could get into that, and I'm aware of that.
Idle and 2FLS.
By the way, was there a Super Bowl, and if so, who won?
New Orleans.
Electric fan, W2ILT clear.
New Orleans, fantastic. They needed that.
Newsline report number 1695 with a release date of Friday, February 5th, 2010. The follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. CQ Magazine files a rulemaking request to give hams more leeway under Section 97.113 for rescue radio training. A Texas ham asks the FCC to create a United States 4-meter band. And the National Conference of Volunteer Examination Coordinators again revises the recently revised technician class question pool. Find out on Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 1695 coming your way right now.
From around the world, this is Newsline, Amateur Radio's first independent on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now, reporting, here is Don Wilbanks, AE5DW.
One of the nation's leading ham radio publications is joining a movement to modify Section 97.113 of the Amateur Service Rules. This permits hams and the employ of government or relief agencies to take part in disaster training drills. Amateur Radio Newsline's Mark Abramovich, NT3V, has the rest of the story. Mark.
To hear talk among some in the amateur radio community, the FCC's decision to offer an interpretation of this rule more than a year ago without the filing of a complaint or request for clarification still is puzzling and even troubling. The Commission Legal Counsel Enforcement Officer read a posting on a bulletin board by a ham who helped his hospital put together a disaster plan and then participated in the drill. That ham got a communication from the FCC saying he was in violation of the provision of 97.113 regarding pecuniary interest and an employer benefiting from amateur radio. The perception by some of this heavy-handed approach by the new FCC administration sent shockwaves among not only the amateur community, but those it serves. The result, some organizations backed away altogether from using the services of amateur radio for fear they could come under FCC scrutiny. Then, a clarification from the FCC that waivers could be granted. What followed? A petition by a group of hams led by noted radio instructor Gordon West, WB6NOA, seeking to change the rule to allow hams to take part in disaster training exercises put on by their employers. But CQ Magazine editor Rich Moses in W2VU says so much more is at stake, and that's why he filed a more inclusive petition with the FCC.
We realized in reading through all this that really
the time
this interpretation goes beyond disaster and emergency
information.
A very strict reading of this rule
repeater
means, for example, that I, as an employee of CQ Communications, would not be able to do equipment repeaters, or at least not if it involved transmitting. And for decades, staff members of magazines have been doing equipment reviews, and it's never been a problem. But if you read this closely, if I transmit for the purpose of doing an equipment review, then I'm in violation of the rules.
But Moses says the FCC's interpretation of this rule goes even further and could impact the amateur radio on the International Space Station program.
Everyone thinks it's a wonderful program. It's good for NASA. It's good for ham radio. It's good for kids. It's good for the national interest in promoting young people's interest in science and technology by allowing them to communicate with astronauts on board the space station via amateur radio. No one questions the value of this program. But the astronauts are NASA employees, and they are clearly communicating on behalf of their employer when they are operating in an ARIS contact.
Moses says even though the astronauts are making those contacts on their free time, if you look at the FCC interpretation, they too are in violation. So Moses says it's time to act. He suspects the American Radio Relay League also will weigh in shortly.
My understanding was that the ARRL board was going to consider at its meeting a couple of weeks ago filing its own petition. My guess is that the FCC will wait until the league files its petition and then group all three of them, or more if there have been others filed as well, into a single petition that is put out for initial public comment.
In the meantime, Moseson says the interpretation stands and waivers have to be sought. Moseson says it's clear this issue won't be decided quickly. In most cases, he says, it could take up to a year or more for the FCC to issue a final decision. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Mark Abramovich, MT3V, in Philadelphia.
You can read the entire story on the CQ petition to change Section 97.113 of the Amateur Service Rules, beginning on page 8 and continuing on page 114 of the February 2010 issue of that magazine. It's also online at the URL found in this week's printed Amateur Radio Newsline report. URZ.com lead moderator Glenn Zook, K9STH of Richardson, Texas, has filed a petition for rulemaking to the FCC, one aimed at creating a 70.0 megahertz to 70.500 megahertz amateur radio band in the United States. Amateur Radio Newsline's Bruce Tennant, K6PZW, has more.
In his January 27th filing, Glenn Zook, K9STH, notes that the 4-meter band spectrum at 70 megahertz has been authorized in a growing number of European and African nations. He says that by establishing such privileges for amateur radio operators in the United States and other areas over which the Commission has jurisdiction, it would be of great benefit to those operators residing in such areas. According to Zook, the recent migration of broadcast television stations to primarily the UHF frequencies has basically eliminated any probable interference to television channels 4 or 5, which otherwise might have occurred. This is because the 4-meter band is located on frequencies that were allocated to television channel 4. Since the 4-meter amateur radio band does not fall in the 72.0 megahertz to 76.0 megahertz segment, which is allocated to operational fixed and various mobile services, there would be no potential co-channel or adjacent channel interference. In his proposal, Zook suggests that the FCC allow all classes of amateur radio operators operating privileges on this new band. However, he also suggests that novice class licensees be restricted to a lower output level than those allowed for technician, general, advanced, and extra class licensees. He says that if the present maximum power output limitation of 1,500 watts PEP is granted to the higher class licensees, then the novice class licensee should be restricted to no more than 200 watts power output, as per most of the privileges granted those operators who hold a novice class license. It should be noted that there are still a small number of low-band VHF television transmitters in operation, and their owners will likely oppose the creation of a new ham band at 70 megahertz. That said, the level of opposition from broadcasters will likely be far less than it would have been before the digital television transition of June 2009. That's when most of the nation's VHF low-band stations on channel 2 through 7 migrated to channels in the UHF range. If the FCC decides to issue it a rulemaking designation, Glenn Zook's petition to create a ham radio allocation at 70 megahertz is likely to garner a lot of support from within the ham radio community, especially from those who operate in the world above 50 megahertz. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Bruce Tennant, K6PZW in Los Angeles.
And you can read the entire K9STH filing online at the URL in this week's printed Amateur Radio Newsline report. An FCC-led telecommunications assessment team is on the ground in Haiti evaluating the status of that country's communications infrastructure. This following the devastating earthquake that struck that island nation on January 12th. The telecommunications experts were deployed in coordination with the United States Agency for International Development. They came in response to a request from the Director General of Haiti's CONATEL, which is the nation's telecommunications regulatory agency in that quake-devastated nation. The FCC team was led by International Bureau Chief Mendel de la Tour. She and the others will continue to work with CONATEL and local Haitian telecommunications providers to come up with practical options for restoring communication services to the people of Haiti. Speaking from Port-au-Prince, de la Tour said that after seeing the destruction in the country, and particularly the telecommunications infrastructure, that she now has a much better understanding of the monumental task to keep communications up and running in such a difficult environment. She added that it's clear that the telecommunications sector is making a huge difference on a day-to-day basis for Haitians struggling with tremendous personal and property losses. Bureau Chief Delatorre has also taken...